Today, I'm joined by Michelle Vu, VP of Revenue and Customer at G2. Bringing over 20 years of comprehensive sales experience, Michelle is an accomplished sales leader with a love for all things sales. Her experience consists of 11 years of sales leadership and 9 years of being an individual contributor. She has spent the last 7 years at G2. Before G2, she had a long tenure at CareerBuilder and also Quill.com. The show has honed her expertise in building a collaborative, high-performing sales culture and has been recognized for her commitment to developing sales professionals, not just in their sales career, but by helping them set and achieve personal goals that will improve their lives as a whole. Michelle resides in the Chicago area and has 2 young kids. In her free time, she's in the final month of the University of Chicago Chief Revenue Program, and she loves to run, read suspense books, and play tennis. Michelle, super excited to have you on today.
Thank you for having me, Mattson. Looking forward to chatting.
Well, I am, you know, personally, I use G2 all the time, like many of your the people that you may interact with, right? I use G2 to check out and see, you know, what people think about certain tools that I'm evaluating. I obviously use it on our side as well. We are a happy customer. Really excited to talk with you about the other side that I don't know about as much about, which is revenue at G2. So before diving in, I would love to have you speak to our audience a little bit about your background and kind of your growth trajectory and how you just found yourself now there as a senior revenue leader at G2.
Happy to. All right. Well, I think in a maybe not original first job, I actually had a sales quota at 15. So I have been doing any type of sales-related activity since my very first job. I had to do some medical surveys when I was 15. And so from there, I'm like, oh, I love the competitive aspect. The more I got, the more bonus I achieved. And so it was kind of just instilled in me and seeing like, okay, I really like this. So even throughout my college career, which my fun fact is I actually have my Bachelor of Fine Art, so I am an artist. Back in the day, there was no sales degree, which I know now some programs have, which is incredible. But during that time, I was working at a car dealership. I served in food service. I did a lot of things that I knew I could just to make more money on the side. I didn't know that it would turn out to be my full career. And so I think it's funny how life works out that way. I just really liked it. I liked the thrill of the hunt, talking to people, just the fact that I could make the amount of money that I it's not like stuck on one amount all year. And so from there, out of college, I went into a BDR role, which a BDR role then was door-to-door office supply sales. So I had a zip code, and so I had to go to 45 businesses a day. Shout out to all my old coworkers back in the day. It was a grind. You started in the office, then you came back at 5:30 with your sheet and hopefully some order forms. And it really, you know, the phrase cut your teeth, like that was full on, because you're getting rejection like just right to your. And it's really hard to keep going. And you don't have somebody watching you the whole time. And so you really have to have that drive and like, you know, you got to do this on your own type of thing. So I did that for a number of years. It actually moved me to Iowa. I'm from Nebraska, moved me to Iowa. And then from Iowa, moved me here in Chicago because the headquarters of Quill is here. And I transitioned more into not as fun as BDR-esque, but I would call and set meetings and then go out. And so I was more in the outside sales realm. And so early on there, I was approached to lead a team. So I interviewed. I never thought I was going to be a leader. I was just trying to stay in my own lane, do my own thing. And I had a leader see something in me, which is I'm very appreciative to this day. And I got the role and I learned so much. I mean, being 24 years old and having 21 direct reports at that time, which thank goodness ratios are better these days. Yeah, that would never fly nowadays. Good for your sales efficiency, because obviously you don't have a lot of overhead with more sales leaders. But I realized at that, like a very, very pivotal moment in my career, that I didn't have enough experience if I wanted to do bigger things. And so I went back into being an IC into, and that's when I went over to CareerBuilder. So I was an individual contributor there, working with some larger companies, and then worked my way back into leadership. And I have been in leadership ever since. So once I left CareerBuilder, I came over to G2 as a frontline leader. One of our first that we were on the acquisition side, so just land, which I had never led just a land team before, and it was really fun. And my evolution of 7 years here has been helping build and, you know, building the land team. I've worked into also expand, which is where I'm at today, focused on making sure that we have happy customers and getting some expansion that way. So a little bit about the journey. It was not planned to be in sales leadership, but I truly, you know, it goes to show, like, leaders make an impact. They notice things about you, and making sure you are pulling people up when you are noticing things about those folks that you work with, because it's important. Because I didn't raise my hand because I didn't really know.
I really love your story. One, I mean, I also commiserate with you on the start of your career being door to door. I did security, pest, some other sales jobs that were door to door, not office supplies. That's like another level. But it was anyway. So yes, door to door sales is the school of hard knocks. Something that really stuck out to me though was, and I thought it was a pretty bold move by you, was deciding as a leader with 21 direct reports that you didn't have the experience you needed to move to the next level, and then you decided to jump back down to be an IC. What triggered that? And two, like, what gave you the courage to make that jump?
You know, it's hindsight. I think I was really ahead of the game. I didn't realize the impact it would have when I actually made that decision and had an opportunity to make a change. It was me wanting to get into the tech space because I was not. Mm-hmm. I was working and selling, you know, office supplies at that time. Mm-hmm. It was school districts and working on bids and RFPs for all of their supplies, and having an opportunity to get back into tech. It's like I don't have. Where is the rapport? If I come in and try to sell something, I don't have a background to do that as a leader. So in order to, in my future self, have a better respect and credibility with the team that I'm managing, I need to cut my teeth in that regards and have that. And I would say it was very humbling to move back, but I also feel like I had a different perspective of what my manager was dealing with and all of the things that people see leaders do versus what they see a manager does. Same person, but everybody wants to be a leader. They don't realize all the things that come with management. And so it was a good switch in perspective, and, you know, doing that for a number of years and, you know, having an opportunity to step in back into the leader role at the time that made sense.
Yep. Yeah. Love that. That decision. I'm sure that there are those listening who, you know, face similar big move decisions in their lives, and it's good to hear that the stories where it panned out. And in hindsight, that is a good decision, right? That's the hard thing with decisions. You don't know in the moment.
Yeah, at 25 years old, I don't know if I was like that. This is going to be a game changer. But it's kind of just following your gut and taking an opportunity, even though, I mean, I didn't know if I would even get a job in tech because I had not done it before, and just really leaning into not knowing what I'm doing and just seeing how far I can get, type of thing.
Yeah. Well, fast forward to today, you lead, a revenue function. You are obviously well respected, especially at G2. Your career trajectory there has been, it's very clear, starting out in management, moving up to where you are now. You've been around setting up go-to-market for success for a long time. And one thing I'd like to get your perspective on, because I personally think it's important, you can tell me otherwise, if you think otherwise, is getting your ICP definition and your understanding crisp before executing like crazy across the revenue organization. would love to get your take on, you know, what are some of the factors that go into really nailing the ICP understanding, not just at like the definitional level, but making sure that everybody within your organization is singing from that same sheet music. Yeah, we'd love to get your perspective on that.
Yeah.
I see that as kind of like the tip of the spear before you start really moving forward.
It is, because it can be a very expensive mistake if you put all your eggs in one basket and that basket does not retain, and or it doesn't stick, or however your business model is, if it is a trial based or, you know, it's a longer term strategy play, sometimes that you won't feel it until multiple renewal cycles in the future. I think one of the things that maybe in what I've seen in just the being in the industry, talking to a lot of different vendors in the space, sometimes we get, just like reps get, it's like you get happier and you're like, ooh, okay, this one customer, this feels like it's set. I'm going to see if I can get more and then just see if it sticks. And not really thinking about what the end impact could be versus like the now gratification that they believe in what you're selling, but we don't really know the impact that it's going to have. And so I think it's you have to appease your board and like getting revenue in, but you will have to also have to make sure that this is going to be sustainable revenue, and so that you know, do become a cash flow positive organization and all the great things that come with being successful in that. And so I think one thing that sometimes gets lost along the way with figuring out your ideal customer profile is not talking to the customers and just talking internally about what we think. And so really having a good committee of customers or potential customers and just being very open, and it shouldn't be the salespeople talking to them. It should be more product and maybe marketing, just learning and seeing like, well, what would it look like if we did this, or how does this mean? What does this mean to you and your organization? And trying to nail what it could be. And if you don't do that, in my opinion, I think you can get yourselves going literally, what is the phrase? An inch deep and a mile wide, and you're just not, you're all over, and you don't have a good direction. And then if you don't have a good direction, then your sales team doesn't have a good direction. And then we're just kind of going all over and trying to take whatever deal that we get, which does not create like long-term sustainable revenue.
Yeah, I really appreciate your thoughtful answer there. One thing that stuck out to me right at the beginning was you said that go talk to your customers, and then you followed that up with essentially don't rely on call recordings from sales reps to feed you all of your information effectively, right? Like your sales team. So why are you saying have someone else other than a salesperson speak with your customers to get that product market fit information?
Well, I think it's the natural human nature. Maybe just having been a salesperson, you know, I know sometimes like people are like, ooh, what's she gonna do? What's she gonna ask me? Is this a leading question? And so I think it brings the barrier down. You know, you're a customer of ours. I could ask you some questions. You're like, what is she asking me for? And so having that barrier gone and it not being just the sales team asking, and having more inquisitive minds on product, having like the creative aspect too, because I'm in sales, I'm creative, but I'm not in creative and seeing how our product could be better, you know? I do think there's something to be said with that.
Got it. So product isn't traditionally considered part of, you know, the revenue organization, though like they obviously build the thing that feeds the revenue organization. How much do you involve product typically? And does that vary in like kind of defining your ideal customer profile, and what role do they play? Because I think that's an interesting thing.
I think it's a good question. I haven't had like we've refined a lot as we've grown, and a lot of it is, you know, we are revenue driven, but you know, product enhanced, I guess, if I were to say, just making sure that we are aligning towards the same goal. And you know, one thing that we've done differently in the last year here is really working on a target account strategy and finding the weight of the customer targets and then the prospect targets and making sure that everything we're doing internally is towards our top accounts versus the ones that aren't, don't have a high product market fit or high high renewable dollars or whatever it might be. And so when we're in our conversations internally, we're mainly talking about those top tier accounts and like where the impact has made.
Yeah. Now, actually, that's a great answer. And it also, I think, tees up what I would love to talk to you about next. Is like once you've got your ICP defined, your ideal customer profile defined, you were mentioning in your specific case at G2 right now, you're running an account-based strategy or an account-based motion where you're identifying key accounts, you're essentially identifying the key properties that are associated with those accounts and the people that are at those accounts to then prioritize those, right? To me, you're beginning to get into play design, like actually running plays, executing specific dedicated motions to acquire those customers. Before teams began getting into tactics, right? Like we want to look at these buying signals or we want to use this intent data. What are some of the key factors to consider as teams are thinking through what motions will work for us? What should we be looking for to tell us which accounts might be ripe to go after today versus others? What are some of the factors that teams, revenue leaders, even those on the front lines should be considering when they're prioritizing and making these types of decisions?
Yeah, I think I'll speak a little bit more just in general from talking to a lot of leaders in the space and experience. I think making sure that you're really looking at your segmentation model and not necessarily like when I say segmentation, not like you have it blocked by employee size or industry, who your target segments are when you're doing plays and who you think in those segments are going to be the most successful in to convert. And so that comes with a lot of trial and error in, you know, not doing big spending yet. You had to try to understand where the focus could lie. And that does come in to looking at what are the motion and behaviors of the segment or that ideal customer profile within that segment, because you have the ICP, but then there's going to be some offshoots in it. Like one is going to be a little bit more valuable than the other. And a lot of that does come with that trial and error. And then once you can kind of understand like their buying behavior and their learnings, you model off those plays based on where they're going to be at in a sense. And so it could look different between each segment. If you have to have a completely different, maybe it's a digital play with a certain segment, maybe, you know, you're doing something, I don't know if people do direct mail, you have to really think about what approach would match that persona of the segment that you're going after. Does that track?
Yeah, so what I'm hearing is ground yourself in your understanding of each of your distinct segments that you're going after. And the core problems that they are trying to address, and the where they live, where they engage, listen for how they make decisions, and then be sure you're showing up in those in ways that align very closely with where your segment kind of lives, right?
Yeah.
Your team, they understand the ICP. You've aligned across the organization on what that is. They're running plays that vary depending on where these people fit within the decision process. At this point, I guess I would be curious. One thing that's coming up time and time again is throughout this entire process, AI is there to help, right? AI is there to help. I'm curious to get your perspective on where do you see AI helping today? As of like this moment,
yeah.
Because we know that it's moving quickly and the power that it's bringing to the organization, revenue organization is changing rapidly. Where do you see AI being most helpful today?
This is something I'm glad it's like today because who knows what it's going to be tomorrow. But really being smarter with the time and, you know, I wouldn't say as much like yes, you can leverage to write emails, and I know that there is a place there, but sometimes it's kind of like you can see the telltale signs of if it was an AI-generated email, and so being very careful with that. But what about how you're doing your call prep or your champion building and just trying to understand what's happening at the organization, what questions to ask, thinking just outside the box of what you normally have been doing? I think it's a good use of AI. And of course, a lot of our tech stack that, you know, everyone has out there has AI built in. And so it is making our sales teams in general be smarter. And, you know, if you can help with, you know, whatever sales methodology that you have, it's going to tell me from that call, did I hit all the marks on some of the pieces that I needed? And it's going to help coach me and do better. That's something I love because it's helping us move a little bit faster while also learning along the way. But in the now, we still need the human perspective. We still need to really understand how to run a very well planned out sales process. We can't do that with AI. We can just let it assist us in some of the tasks that we know we don't need. And obviously you need to train it and make sure that you are feeding it with the right information to get out what you're looking for, and you can't trust it all the way. But thinking about, like, we have like a 10% more Slack channel, and that's like, what could you do with AI that's going to give you 10% back or do 10% more? And so the people are throwing it all the time on like, oh, I tried this and I used this and this was the outcome. And that's really it. It's just like, what are you testing out? Because if you're not testing, if you're not doing anything, you're like a year and a half behind. Mm-hmm. So you're not going to get very far if you just rely on yourself with it.
I like that 10% better concept. How do you formalize in any way? It sounds like it's more ad hoc and more take what you think will help you, but have you formalized any way for people to say, hey, here's the collection of things from this channel that everybody should now be doing as just standard practice? Or are you guys still kind of waiting to kind of standardize on a set of like AI toolkit, best practices?
It's a good question. We don't have like the set best practice from, and this is our whole company-wide of seeing like across the organization are doing, but making sure you're leveraging it for call prep, making sure you're leveraging the AI inside of the tech stack that we already have to be smarter with your call notes or however you're utilizing it. Like those are some things that are a must do, but some of the more creative approaches are like on the customer side, what are some of the, you know, analyze some data for me. Are there some triggers that could put this like an account set at risk? Are there, you know, there's things that you could do as long as you're, you know, you're not on the public domain and doing some searches that can really help you be a little bit smarter with your approach.
Yeah. Question for you. Have you ever been duped into actually believing that an AI generated message was from a human? And by duped, I mean in as positive way as possible. Yeah. Did you respond and think, oh, this is a good message?
Well, you know, it's good. I don't know, Mattson, if it was, because the person didn't tell me that they used AI.
Sure.
But it's you can see it. But as long as you're running it and then you're putting you're humanizing it, that's great. Mm-hmm. Do an initial run through with it, whatever, if you're using a software that does it, then humanize it. Change it up. Make it you, because it still needs to be you on the other side, you know?
What I'm hearing from you is, hey, there's a lot of repetitive tasks that don't have to be for example, account research, right? You need to be directionally really correct, right? And then, yes, there are some nuances that you can then dig into as an individual to get to that like last 10%, right? But for by and large, research is a really gray area where AI can show up. You know, call recordings, understanding how you can improve as a seller. Yeah. That's something that can be done, right? That AI is good at synthesizing the information and giving you a response as to what you should do to improve.
Even going back to our ICP conversation, if you know the traits, why don't you put in to your, like, LLM, understand, okay, what are the things that like these type of companies most care about? What are, you know, you could do some broader searches to have an understanding of what's happening within the industry or that persona that you're going after, just to be smarter with it.
We've been talking a lot about tools and intent data and, you know, your ICP and those scores live somewhere. One challenge that I perceive being being relatively omnipresent within revenue and sales development organizations is tool sprawl and just this whole tab hopping concept where reps and even managers are jumping between tool to tool to tool to piece together the entire picture. I feel like I'm on customer calls all the time where this is discussed. Is how, as a revenue leader and as a revenue organization, how do you simultaneously stay on top of like the latest and greatest? Because tools are not inherently evil. They are just tools, right? But sometimes it feels like the tools are here to eat us, but they should be here to help us, right? So how do you set up your organization to succeed and like to build a tool stack that is there to really help you, as opposed to maybe becoming some sort of like Frankenstack situation where you're just like drowning in tools, but like you lack information and actually insight.
Right. Yeah. Well, I will absolutely do a shameless plug of leveraging G2.com to understand what is needed for your business. That's going to be my only official plug, Mattson. But that is, you know, that is why we're here, is to educate buyers to make sure that you're making the right decision. And I think it's hard because in general, we can get really excited, especially on sales, like, ooh, get really bought in if we're sold the right way, if it feels like it makes sense. But if I'm the only one bought in and no one that's actually going to use it bought in, then like, whoa, that was a waste of all time and money. So I think it's trying to have there be an owner within an organization that does oversee all tech, that can have a non-biased view on the impact of the tech and what is needed, and having, you know, subcommittees when you're making the decisions all the way down to the end user, so that it isn't a waste of time. That does two things. Of course, one, it's making sure that this would fit into the day-to-day, but two, it's also giving some more experience and more like up leveling and skilling to those end users that like get a little bit of an inside view into the buying process. They get more of a voice into how we're making decisions. In turn, because it's a sales tool, you also see it's cool for a seller to see another seller sell to us and understand like, what does that sales process look like? What could we learn from? What are, you know? Mm-hmm. So I think no matter what, we have to use it. There are some incredible tools out there. Again, go to G2 and check out what you need to solve within your tech stack problems. But you have to really take into account how much they're spending and like doing even an evaluation with your team before you purchase on like some larger tech, like rip and replace tech, on how much a time spent survey, like what is really happening in the day in and day out of your team? How much time are you spending doing admin? How much time are you spending doing other things so that you can have a better understanding of the impact of that tool?
Yeah. It sounds to me, as you're listing off all these things that you would want to consider if you are setting up technology, right, within your organization, there are a lot of considerations these days that companies are taking that maybe they weren't taking in 2021, let's, for example. Mm-hmm. Maybe as like a quick side tangent here, and then we can come back. But look, generating pipeline, we also heard it. We all feel it. It's harder than maybe it has been in the past. There might be a few out there that don't deal with this, but by and large, it's harder to generate pipeline. Deal cycles, by and large, have slowed, depending on the segment. How can sellers, and you know, even sales development reps, but how can sales teams maybe be better about understanding the context within an organization, right? Is understanding that deep level context critical to like moving deals along? Are you finding that like that deep understanding is helping your best sellers win? Or is it diminishing marginal returns and they shouldn't exhaust themselves on trying to understand all the things that you just listed that you will be considering, right, when thinking about technology?
Yeah, I think, yes, it can be painful in the now, but it's going to remove surprises in the future. Because the biggest thing is like, if you're moving quickly and you're not figuring out your blockers or asking the tough questions, then we get you have this deal and commit, or you're good, you're feeling good, and then all of a sudden you feel like your feet are, you know, the rug's pulled under from you because there was something that you didn't dig in on based on what the decision criteria was or whatever it might be. And so I think getting the hard questions out early in a nice way, not in a interview style way of just trying to say, hey, how does this all work? Just really setting it up to not waste the customer's time too, and saying, typically what we're seeing is we need to go through these different decision paths. Does that work at your organization, or how have you last purchased a tool? Because I just want to make sure that we are on a set timeline that does make sense. I think if we stop to do that, it slows a little bit in the now, but it's going to definitely pay off in the future.
You mentioned deal risk. It's really interesting. Just the change, even in the last few years, in like the amount of deal risk and where the risk is coming from. And I'm curious if you've identified any trends or patterns in terms of, generally speaking, as a buyer and as a revenue leader, where are you seeing maybe risk show up in deals that maybe it didn't pop up in the past? Like, what are some of those key factors that are rearing their heads that are catching maybe people who, your unaware sales rep by surprise?
The one that instantly came to my mind is the CFO needs to be your best friend. If there has not been a discussion about the head of finance or whatever it's called in that organization, they are going to look at it, because different from 2 years ago, the head of finance is looking at every contract in most, like, not to generalize, but in most deals, no matter what the size, even, because of making sure that we are risk averse, making good decisions, and like ensuring that like our sales and marketing efficiency is doing well and all of that. So understanding what the CFO cares about, what they need to see, making sure they understand where the value and what pain you're solving with this tool, which is hard to get to that person, but it's important that they know the context of the, like, what you're selling.
Got it. Yeah. Maybe an entire episode's worth of content right there, because that's a different type of persona that I think, to your point, teams were not used to needing to bring in, right? The proxy was, oh, we'll get with the CRO or the COO or depending on who your executive buyer depending on the technology you're selling, that used to suffice, right? Getting there. But now it's all roads lead back to the CFO, right? Or that financial officer, whatever their title is.
Yes.
Okay. I'd like to finish. I know you've got a lot of, you mentioned at the beginning, you've got a lot of experience leading teams from the very beginning of your career till now. I'd love to hear some of your, some of the things maybe you've learned about building team culture, keeping team members engaged, right? Maybe people aren't hopping as much as they used to. Like, how do you keep them happy at your organization and build a winning culture for your revenue organization? We'd love just to hear your perspective on that, because I know that's something you've got some perspective on.
Yeah, it's definitely something I'm very passionate on. I think that sometimes the human element gets lost in sales because we are numbers driven, we're competitive, we're trying to get the signature, right? It comes down to that. But because sales is such a volatile role, I mean, you could be on a high 1 month and then, which you naturally will, because it's hard to like keep it up every single month. So you need to know how to control your emotion and like your motivators when things are going poorly. And so why this ties into culture is I do feel, and what I learned throughout my management and leadership career, is really understanding the why behind why that person is at the company selling for this company and what their motivators are outside of the company. Because we don't do this for fun. We don't like have people say no in our face for fun. I mean, some people might, but you know, there is a reason, and you know, maybe it's paying off a college loan or buying a house or going on a trip or getting a different education. There's things that tie into that. And so that has always been like in my core belief system. Every team I've had them make a vision board. I know it sounds silly, but I still do it to this day. We do vision boards. We talk about the things that we're excited about, because that's where the camaraderie comes in. Because you can see, oh my goodness, so-and-so hit their goal. Amazing. Let's celebrate them. It's not, yes, they close a deal, but what happened? They were able to pay for something, and then we celebrate that way. And so it goes back to the human element. And I've been maybe something that isn't as popular in the VP level role is I am not a fear-based leader. I am true empathetic leader, and I will always be. And I do not think that you have to be just like hard on the numbers in order to get results. I think you have to build, at least for me, what works is I want to build a foundation and get to know my people, understand all about them, their motivators, like I mentioned, understand like how they like to be recognized, and make sure my actions show that, so that when times do get tough, they know I'm coming from that place of like wanting them to succeed versus maybe more selfishly like needing a number to come forward, because I want them to go up to their career wherever. Hopefully it's at the same organization, but wherever it might land. Because I look back at like my path, and I've had people believe in me, and I want to make sure that I am pulling people up that way too.
Yeah, I think the overarching theme from your response there is that you got to remember that we're in a business of humans still, right? We're still dealing with, people with lives that aren't entirely, bent on us getting a number, right? Hitting our number. I think that a lot of companies do try to celebrate the wins, right? But what I like about your approach is that it expands beyond, hey, we won from a company perspective because this person won. It's, hey, we won, yes, but it's a win-win for our company and in their personal life. And you're celebrating those actual personal wins, not just the clout that they're building within the organization, or not just the traditional wins channel that you might have. So love that. But the empathetic leader approach. We're almost at time here. What I want to do is ask you two questions really quickly in succession. And then we'll be off. You ready?
Yeah, let's go.
Cool. So what is a sales secret you've learned and incorporated that you think others may not have, or you would have liked to know earlier on in your career?
I think the thing that comes to mind, and it maybe it goes with what I just told you, so I'm telling you all about me, is leaning into where you know you're not good and just going after it. I think for me, I had a lot of imposter syndrome through my career. And I don't know if this is like a sales secret per se, but I just went full on towards the things that I had no idea what I was doing, just to see what I could do. And it opened doors that I never would have had. And so it's really basically embrace something uncomfortable when it comes to like your career would be something that really has helped me.
Okay. So embrace discomfort in your career to progress.
Yeah.
Got
yeah.
it. Good one. Yeah. What's a strongly held belief or a hill that you're willing to die on with regards to your go-to-market strategy or execution?
I am very, having seen it both ways, when like running a full cycle, meaning I'm going to get the logo and then renew the logo versus I have a team of hunters and a team of renewers and expanders. I do feel very strong about the latter, on separating the two and having like just incredibly strong hunters they know how to go after business and sell really strong deals that are going to renew, and having customer account managers or CSMs, however your team has it, that is what they're going to be just so golden at. Now they have to hunt, but I do think it is, when your business is, it has to be big enough, because you do have to start with both. You can't afford to have like two separate segments, but I feel very strongly in the impact that it can make an organization when you have centers of excellence.
Awesome. Well, Michelle, it's been a wealth of insights having this conversation for the last 45 minutes. Really appreciate your time. Anything, where can people find you on social, or how, what's the best way for people to connect with you if they have questions or you know, career advice, that kind of thing?
Yeah, LinkedIn for sure. Michelle Koenig Vu. That is my URL too, so that should be easy to find. Feel free to reach out. Love to continue the connection points in GTM.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Michelle.
Thanks, Matson.